Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, July 7th. Global politics and tariff uncertainty stand to shake consumer confidence and the outlook for tourism, our number one industry. Add to that an upheaval at the Hawaii Tourism Authority, and we have to pause to consider how to keep our heads above water for the remainder of 2025. We continue our conversations with industry leaders. We hear about a situation with no federal halfway houses for former inmates. Hawaii is one of two states in this predicament. We also mark the history of the arrival of the Catholic missionaries to the islands with a look at the roots of the head of the Vatican, the first American pope. And we look at an unlikely resource to tell us more about ocean pollution. Plus, images from a protest decades ago are on display at the Whitney Museum in New York. We hear from the artist. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We are dealing with global political tensions and worries about rising costs with all this on-again, off-again tariff talk. And if that wasn't enough, the dysfunction at the Hawaii Tourism Authority has triggered a reboot and a new governance structure. Can we get back on track again? Today we hear from Keith Vieira, the former Starwood Resorts executive, now with KV Associates, a tourism consulting firm. He shares his hopes and fears about what's ahead. Governor Josh Green is in the process of selecting new members for what is now an advisory board. Can the HTA find its way back? And what to do about marketing and management? Should we go back to using more hotel room tax, the transit accommodations tax, or TAT, to market the islands? And why can't there be better enforcement of illegal short-term rentals, or STRs, in our neighborhoods? Here's Vieira.
It is a critical time, and there is hope that with change and with new people that maybe you'll get more creativity. Maybe the people will understand the importance of the visitor spending being the key measure, not number of visitors. Type of visitors are a crucial part because you want spenders. But hopefully there's recognition that if you want visitor spending, you have to market.
And so this new revamp of the Hawaii Tourism Authority, what are your hopes and what are your concerns?
On one hand, the previous one wasn't working, the infighting, because of the number of legislators that are on there and the political issues, which really held things back. So hopefully they're going to put people with knowledge, industry knowledge, business knowledge, community knowledge, not a lot of strong activists trying to look at what's in it for them or their group that they represent, and understand that Hawaii's got a very strong brand, still do. But we also have challenges on the horizon. It is a lot more expensive to come here and eat here and live here. We have global competition, which we never had because of the internet and going online and the different things you can buy. And we relied on wholesale distribution. Now it's online marketing, it's frequent travel programs. So how we spend our money has to change. But we have to spend money to get people here.
And we're at a point where we've got a soft summer coming up, and that makes people leery about how we're going to finish out 2025.
Yeah, I mean, for Hawaii, because we are basically a 93% leisure destination, nobody has to come here. They're not coming here for work. They can make a lot of different choices. And for us as a destination, it's about booking pace. We need to put X amount on the books 60 to 90 days out, X amount on the books at 90 to 120 days out. And pretty much looking what's coming on the books, you can tell what kind of year or what kind of season it's going to be. But when the summer runs empty and you're running specials to try to fill the summer, and I say run empty means softer than usual, it affects the fall and affects next year, first quarter. So unless we get ahead of ourselves, how do you possibly get your pace back? And then you compare that 20 years ago, we were spending $100 million in marketing, and today we're spending less than 30.
And then we've got a situation, too, where there's some animosity with the U.S. I know when we talked to Governor Ben Cayetano, he said we should be doing more to reach out to our Canadian friends. And I know the fall, the winter, is when we see the snowbirds. But what more can be done to boost our image when it's really taking a hit?
You got to get the message out there that Hawaii welcomes you. And we haven't had a welcoming message in a long time. We spent millions on Malama. If you come here, do the work and be conscious, and you should be conscious of the environment, but that's not an inviting message. So we have to go back to doing what we do well, which is our brand is a welcoming. Everybody hears, you travel anywhere in the world and you say you're from Hawaii, Hawaii. It's a welcoming message. So we have to go back to that. And if we're not marketing at all, which is basically happening right now, we're arguing over $6 million. We should be arguing over $66 million. You're not going to get business, and it's going to come last minute like we're relying on now.
And we're in a situation, too, where the convention center is going to be shut down because of the repairs needed for the roof. And that's pretty unsettling because that's a couple of years, and those kinds of meetings need to be done way in advance.
Yes, that is unsettling, especially when people understand this is a state project. What happens on every state project? It gets delayed, and numerous reasons for the late finishing. So that's a concern because there's no way a meeting planner is going to book something. Oh, it will be done. Meeting planners cannot expose themselves like that. It's not a leisure traveler who 60 days out can say, we'll go to Cancun instead. Once they plan to come here, you cannot tell them, oh, by the way, our center's not working. Now, we can do more on the private industry side between the larger hotel groups, Hilton, Sheraton, etc. You can offset some of that. But no question, it has an effect on us. And for us, we've got to grow our group market, not shrink our group market.
Where do you see us going at this point? Because now we will have an advisory board, a new CEO. What are your hopes?
My hope is that somebody's going to understand at some point that the TAT is now $1.2 billion. That was done to fund marketing and that was done to fund the convention center. $1.2 billion that goes into the general fund. Why isn't some of that dedicated directly to tourism marketing? In my view, if you want to settle this and have an advisory board, all that great, but you need to dedicate 12 to 15% of the TAT to tourism marketing. I think that's the only answer that gives the stability that it's a multi-year, you can sign the Pro Bowl for 5 years because you know you've got the money for 5 years. Unless we do that, we're doing what we're doing right now, arguing over a couple of million dollars and where we can spend it in the fall.
So we're sweating the small stuff.
Yes. And people forget how important visitor spending is to us.
Maui is going through a tough time still, given what happened with the wildfires. And there were some mixed messages. Where do you see recovery in that area going?
Maui has unique challenges. West Maui, which is arguably the prime destination on Maui, and the impact of the area. And those of us that aren't physically there have no understanding of what those people went through, what the employees went through. And it was beyond devastating. And you look at the numbers for such a small area. But there's been pretty good recovery. There's just, again, you don't have any base. You have very little group base, and you still have a mixed message, and you don't have a marketing message. Where's the welcome to Maui? We want you back. Every time that is proposed, how are you going to fund it? And also, is it sensitive to everyone there? And arguably, there are people always going to feel that, no, we shouldn't have this. It should be a respected area. And you got to respect their beliefs or understand where they come from. But it's 1.2%. I think of the state population, it drives a lot of visitor spending and people have great memories of Lahaina. So can we do something that's respectful, but also drives visitor spending? And I just drove through there last week, the amount of homes being built, so positive. But we have to still decide, what is it? What is the draw? Can we get that to be an artisan's village? Or can that be the place that people go to buy their art and show their art and people can learn more about the culture and history of Hawaii through artisans?
A lot more work needs to be done.
Yes, and I understand it's going to be slow. In the meantime, the hotels are doing better, and hotels are not the key. Hotels will generally always find a way to make some money. It's the small mom-and-pop operators, the surf instructors, the restaurants. They get hit the most because if their business is 80% of what it used to be, they're losing money. They make their profit on the last 10, 15%.
And coming off the pandemic, we relied on the local residents to help shore up the industry, inviting them or urging them to go have a staycation to help the neighbor islands. I don't know, what more needs to be done to shore up the industry as a whole? I know we're seeing more timeshare buildings being built, and that really helped our recovery during the pandemic. But yeah, but what else do you see on the landscape?
We have this unique challenge in front of us. 2009, 68,000 hotel rooms, condos, and timeshare. 6.3 million visitors. 2019, 68,000, actually a little less, but basically 68,000 hotels, condo, and timeshare, 10.4 million visitors. So those last 4 million visitors and a number of previous ones were all staying basically in STRs. And we all like STRs. A lot of us travel with them. But anytime you take up resident housing, that's not a good thing. If you have a condo in Waikiki and you've rented out to visitors, people understand that that's logical. But if you have 5 condos in Kaneohe and you're trying to get them with Airbnb to get short-term rentals because it's profitable, then that's wrong. You shouldn't be allowed to do that. Or if we're going to allow people to do this, then you should pay the same taxes that hotels do. They should be forced to follow the same safety measures that hotels do. But then you have a real hit on what happens to residents and where do they live. So that equation has to be solved. The industry has always supported hosted short-term rentals. And my view, if you're in a residential area like Wailea or Waikiki, you should be able to do it. But if you're in typical residential areas that don't have visitor services, you shouldn't be allowed to do it.
So there needs to be more of a crackdown on those in the neighborhoods, even though they have started and all the counties are working through regulations. But do you think the enforcement is key?
Yeah, I think the enforcement is key because these visitors, and again, we've all been some of them sometime, don't spend the money the way the other visitors do. They're not out dining in the restaurants every night. They're not out playing golf or taking surf instructions. They're hiking, biking, and doing things like that, which is logical. But we need to drive visitors who spend money.
Gosh, I don't know. Anything else about from where you sit and what you hope doesn't happen?
Previous to the pandemic, we had airline strikes. We had hurricanes in 82 and 92. You had 9/11. And the state, including industry and businesses, immediately pulled people together. And I think Ben Cayetano, I remember 2 days after 9/11 being in his office with Waimanalo service station owners. And they were saying, we didn't realize that half of our business was tourists filling up the gas, driving around the island. So Ben pulled us together, got us on a trip to Japan and went to invite people back. And we need that kind of leadership where people understand that visitors and the distribution system that drives visitors, wholesale, etc., need to feel that they're welcome back and that we want their people here. And you can do that through marketing dollars. And when the state spends marketing dollars, industry spends marketing dollars following it. Because when you say come to Hawaii, the industry wants to say stay at my place. So then you have a integrated campaign of a co-op funding. My hope is that we start co-op funding again and we start putting the necessary dollars in the market, which is over $100 million a year.
So it's leveraging that money.
Yeah.
Before Hawaii Tourism Authority was the quasi-agency and set up as Ben did in those days, it was under DBED. It was attached to DBED. And talking to people, they were saying a lot of lawmakers were trying to pull strings and put their pet projects in. I don't know. Are you concerned about that?
Always concerned about that. But prior to HTA, we used to, part of industry businesses, would go at HVCB down to the legislature every year, hat in hand, trying to get money for the following year. When Cayetano pulled together the economic advisory board of business, there was a clear mix of people across all industry in Hawaii. They came to the conclusion that you need to have dedicated funding. It was crucial. And henceforth, the industry supported the TAT, and I think it was 4 or 5% back then, and supported it because they recognized we need to have dedicated funding. Today, we have the highest TAT in the world, and none of it is dedicated funding. That's our challenge with dealing with legislators. They all want the money grab, and they're not willing to invest into the business that drives the revenue.
If you had one message for the governor and the administration with this revamp or reboot of HTA, what would that be?
Put on visionary, creative people, not former legislators. Put people who have had successful businesses and understand that you have to invest to drive revenue, and also understanding the importance of how it's done, but it needs to be done now.
Any other destination that we should look toward and model?
They did that study last year with, I guess, Visit California, whatever it was called, and destination management side of how it's funded, and it kept out the legislators. I think that needs to be done. They need to keep legislators out of what goes on in terms of marketing. They can have input on the quality of the product. They can have input on a lot of things affecting their area, but stay out of the marketing.
Keith Vieira, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was Keith Vieira of KV Associates, a tourism consulting firm, talking to us this morning about the state of our visitor industry and the revamp of the Hawaii Tourism Authority.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Federal funding cuts are reshaping our country. Public media and Hawaii Public Radio are not immune. This is Buffy Cushman Pates, Executive Director of Sikhs Public Charter School and a longtime HPR sustaining member and supporter. If, like me, you're already an HPR member and want more ways to help, please ask a friend to join you in keeping HPR strong. For resources, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
For the past 6 years, Hawaii has been without a federal rehab halfway house. It's one of 2 states without one. Honolulu Civil Beat's Matthew Leonard joins us this morning to talk about their lead story. Good morning, Matthew.
Hey, aloha, Catherine.
Yeah, so I recall over the years, you know, hearing about Mahoney House, but did not realize that it doesn't exist anymore.
Right. And so it was brought out, the building itself was bought by the city and county of Honolulu because they needed to relocate the Sand Island drug treatment facility. And since then, the state has not had a residential facility for returning inmates from federal prison. And that's leading to them being basically put wherever there is space, which is itself limited on the mainland. There's been very little growth in the number of residential halfway house beds in the United States since 2019. And that's a problem because in 2018, President Trump, during his first administration, signed this piece of legislation called the First Step Act that requires the Bureau of Prisons to get people who are eligible out of federal facilities and into these halfway houses or onto monitored release. And that's just not possible with the lack of capacity. And it's a problem that hasn't been solved in the past 6 years in Hawaii.
Gosh, so, you know, what do people do? Where do they go when they're done with serving their time at a federal prison?
Yeah, so they go wherever there's space. So sources in the support community have told me that, you know, there are former federal inmates who are eligible for release who, you know, should be serving out part of their supervised release. So, you know, federal prisoners, they have a custodial sentence and they have what's called supervised release. And supervised release ideally takes place within your community of origin where you're trying to be reintegrated with your family, with community, with the workplace, receiving supports for things like just getting a new social security card, which is a big deal. So that stuff's supposed to happen in the state of origin, and Hawaii inmates are just being sent wherever there's space. It could be in California. Senator Mazie Hirono has heard of cases where they're just sent to Oregon. So essentially, it's really leaving these people and their families in a limbo because they're just not able to be fully integrated back into the community under their supervised release.
And so explain to our listeners then, if someone is out of prison and let's say has to, you know, get a job, that makes it doubly difficult.
Right, and they're required to, and part of the conditions of their release are they're meant to be. If you're in a halfway house in California applying for work, then that has very little connection to what is going to be happening when you move through, say, a six-month period in a halfway house, and you're supposed to be on, say, home monitoring back in Hawaii, and you're supposed to have a job. So there's this series of disconnects where the people are just not able to connect with the jobs that are actually going to be required for them to continue the conditions of their release. And so it's leaving people in this kind of really weird, you know, this really weird kind of limbo state. Ideally, you know, it's cheaper to have people out of federal prison in a halfway house, but it's cheaper still to have them, if they're eligible, on home monitoring, which is the cheapest option. And, you know, in terms of the finances, that's something that people, that's something that the federal authorities and the Bureau of Prison in the second Trump administration are saying they want to happen.
Well, so under this administration, are they going to create new homes?
Right. So good question. And very hard to know whether the administration can actually deliver on this in the short term, because they reiterated just in the last couple of weeks, the new federal prison director, William Marshall, said, you know, yes, we need to be getting these inmates out and into halfway houses. But it's been an intractable problem for over half a decade here in Hawaii, where it's just been very difficult to get a contractor, because most of these houses are run by private contractors who get paid a flat rate to take on board a certain number of inmates and provide support services. And it's just been incredibly difficult here, partly because of the requirements of the buildings that need to conform to the Bureau of Prison requirements, and then just finding someone who's willing to kind of take on the role. It was partially addressed last year with the opening of a day reporting center, which was kind of seen as an interim step, which provides just a limited kind of light version of supervised release support for 30 returning inmates. Mahoney Hale used to cater for 70 people in a residential setting with much more rigorous conditions and much more oversight of their re-entry.
Yeah.
So we're kind of part of the way there, but it's just not. Yeah, the challenges remain. There's no real timeline for when we might see a residential facility here.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Matthew.
Okay, Catherine. Pleasure. Bye.
We've been talking with Civil Beat's Matthew Leonard about Hawaii's lack of residential halfway homes for federal inmates. Read his story online at civilbeat.org. On this day, 198 years ago, the first Catholic priest set foot in the islands. And as the diocese begins to celebrate its bicentennial, it is extending an invitation for Pope Leo XIV, the first American pope, to visit the islands to help mark the event. As we consider the anniversary, we thought we would take you to New Orleans, a community whose diverse population of West Africans, Italians, Spanish, Portuguese, and French were united by one thing: the Catholic Church. Here's a tour guide sharing a story of another pope, Pope John Paul, when he came to visit at the Louisiana Sports Superdome years ago.
And this is where the world's record was set for indoor papal benediction. And when the pope left, there was so much smoke left in the stadium, from the, they're called censors, the smoke in our prayer rise to heavens, that's the ancient thing. Well, there were so much. The stadium smelled like a church. And the Saints fans were so happy. The football team in New Orleans is called New Orleans Saints. And it's not a sacrilegious thing. New Orleans was given a franchise to join the NFL on November the 1st, All Saints Day. You see, it was a sign from heaven.
Ah, who knew? On a recent trip there to NOLA, New Orleans, Louisiana, we connected with the genealogist, Jerry Honore. He is the family historian with the New Orleans Historic Collection. He was the one who discovered that Pope Leo's mother's family hails from the city known as the Big Easy, and that his roots run deep at the city's St. Louis Cathedral. Okay, so do you remember when you made this connection between Pope Leo and New Orleans?
I do. It was on the, morning here in the U.S. when he was elected, May 8th. I listened to his address to the people and his blessing. And within a few minutes after that, I was curious as to who this American was that nobody in America really knew. I knew just from some quick online searching that he was a Chicagoan, but had spent 40 years, a lifetime, in South America. And I think that's what intrigued me most. And being a genealogist, I started working up his father's line and saw that it was of immigrant descent from Italy, France, and shifted to his mother's family, which is Martinez, we tend to say in Louisiana, or Martinez, and realized that they had very deep connections to New Orleans. And that they, just maybe a generation prior to the Holy Father, were identified as people of color. And that was surprising, but also just exciting, because so many of us in Louisiana have that same background.
Well, I mean, the fact that he's So then Creole and Catholic, and you're Creole and Catholic too.
That's right, yes. It's a wonderful gift that Creole Catholics of color here in Louisiana have, in a sense, given to the church. One of the little anecdotes that I love is that he said he's always been open to a vocation because the priest in the community there in Chicago loved to come to his mother's house to eat her cooking. And I said, well, now we know why. She's a Louisiana cook, and you can't top us in terms of food.
Well, okay, so I was at the church just around the corner.
St. Louis Cathedral?
Yeah, St. Louis Cathedral, and I was told that, yes, his mother's family was, I think, baptized there in the church. Is that right?
That's right. Several generations of Pope Leo's family were baptized, confirmed, married within St. Louis Cathedral. In fact, he has an ancestor, Pierre Ponquenet, who was actually the sacristan, the caretaker of the cathedral back in the 1770s, 1780s, 90s. So you can't get more New Orleans than that. And as you've seen, New Orleans is a special place where a church, a Catholic church, is at the very center of the city. Every picture you could buy, every postcard, has Jackson Square with the cathedral in the middle.
And so when you made that connection, I mean, do you remember that moment? You know, were you up in the research room?
I was in the reading room, and I had to contain myself from, you know, from screaming, because I thought I had really stumbled across something when I discovered records from the early 20th century and gone back into the 19th century that all said New Orleans. And then when I discovered that they were people of color from New Orleans, that was just an even bigger surprise.
And I, you know, read a story that said that, yeah, his relatives were enslaved and they owned slaves. And so it's just really a complicated history.
It is. It is. Like myself, like so many of us here, he has ancestors who were free people of color, meaning at some point prior to the Civil War, they were either born free or were manumitted from slavery. And then he has other ancestors who were themselves enslaved, as well as ancestors who were enslavers. So you're right, a complex history. But I think all of us in the U.S. have complex histories, and that's why we have this fascination with genealogy. I think it's some people say it's the second largest or second most popular hobby after gardening.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, you know, when you made this connection, and, you know, did you think, okay, is this right? Did I get this right? Is this accurate? And you, I'm sure, just wanted to tell somebody.
I did. Being a certified genealogist, you know, not rushing to assumptions is something that we preach daily. And yeah, I definitely double, triple, quadruple checked everything and then shared it on social media. I have many friends online who are historians and genealogists, and I thought it would interest them, honestly. I thought they'd be interested in sort of the baguettes, you know, all of the complex layers. But it turns out that the world has been interested in this.
Well, I think because we were all surprised, we didn't think that there was a chance that we would have an American become Pope. And then to have this incredible layered history of his family is just remarkable.
I agree with you. I think that this speaks to the fact that that migration is a part of all of our families. When we thought about Pope Francis and the fact that he was a Pope from the New World, from South America, but of complete Italian ancestry. His ancestors left Italy and went to South America, and now Pope Leo, his ancestors come from many different places in Europe and in Africa, but all sort of converged here in New Orleans, and then around 1910, 1911, his family made that migration northward to Chicago.
I wish I could have been here at the St. Louis Cathedral when they realized the connection. The Mass must just have been incredible.
It was. The Mass was held the very next day, a Mass of Thanksgiving for the election of the new Pope. And our Archbishop, because of the fast work of some of my colleagues at the Archdiocese of New Orleans Archives, they were able to say, yes, absolutely. His ancestors were baptized right here in the cathedral where Mass was being celebrated.
What do you think having a Pope from the U.S. and from New Orleans with his history, what do you think that means to Catholics around the world or even in the U.S.?
I think that a better American pontiff couldn't have been elected. Someone who is from one of the most cosmopolitan cities we have, like Chicago, born in that boomer generation post-World War II, and then to spend a lifetime on mission in South America, obtaining skills in other languages, learning other cultures. I think that Pope Leo will be attuned to diversity, just sort of what a mixed lot we all are, and the universality of the church. We know Catholic by definition means universal, but also the challenges that we still have, the challenges of enculturating different people, different language groups, different cultures. And I know that is still a very sensitive thing in Hawaii, where you have so many different groups of people, and even in the mainland U.S., where now American cities, I think, are changing in demographics rapidly.
And we do have this political climate where the administration is not so friendly with people migrating over here. And so that's sensitive. And it would be interesting to see how Pope Leo navigates circumstances and situations with our president.
I think people will turn to Pope Leo as a voice of clarity and a voice of reason in a way that we had previously looked to our elected leaders as sort of first citizens, people who were all about diplomacy and about civility, maybe not so much anymore, or maybe even definitely not so much anymore. So they're going to turn to religious figures like Pope Leo for that voice.
I know people have said that they hope that Pope Leo can help unite the church. Well, what do you think it will mean for Catholics here in this area?
The church at this point in time, I think, finds itself in recovery mode. There have been so many wounds caused by the church institutionally, Catholics, people of faith who are scarred by a number of things, by the clergy abuse crisis, by parish closures, by the demographic shifts, by racial and social changes. And I think that by emphasizing the mission of the church, which is to evangelize, to comfort, to heal, that may bring people back to the table, both the meeting table as well as, of course, the sacramental table, the altar.
As you think back of when you made that connection in the reading room, what your hopes were at that moment?
In a funny way, I think my hope was very parochial, to use a word. I just hope that it would elevate New Orleans and would bring to mind for people that New Orleans is an incredible city with a rich, rich heritage of faith.
Rich heritage of faith, indeed. You know, and out in front of the St. Louis Cathedral is where we found a young resident named Stan Lee, who's Catholic, and he thinks the new Pope will be good for the city and for Catholics all over the world.
My name is Stanley Womack, and I think the new Pope should be good for New Orleans and the entire world, pretty much. He's a great guy, you know what I mean? He's from America, you know what
I know, did you even imagine that we could get a Pope from the U.S.?
I didn't think so, because I thought it was all Latin, all that type of stuff. So I'm really happy.
And outside in front of the cathedral, a jazz band was set up to entertain passersby. You can bet when and if Pope Leo visits his mother's family's town, it will be quite the party.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents book events for the whole family. On July 19th, author Kealani Netane brings Tala Learns to Siva. And on July 26th, author Pua Aquino brings My Kalo Has Lau. Free admission for children under 10. For tickets and more info, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
Limu, or seaweed, belongs to the algae family, but in terms of its role in the environment, it acts like a sponge and sucks up nutrients and chemicals from the surrounding waters. One of these nutrients is nitrogen, which can turn up in coastal waters due to fertilizer runoff and sewage. The Maui Nui Marine Resource Council has been collecting limu to monitor Maui's coastlines for the past several years. Funding from Maui County's Environmental Protection and Sustainability Division has enabled the nonprofit to expand from South Maui to the North Shore. Sampling on West Maui is planned for this month. The sampling process is low-tech. Volunteers with the Marine Resource Council scramble over rocks and pick the tips off limu. They put the samples on ice and bring it back to the lab, a.k.a. Science Director John Starmer's kitchen. Starmer recently spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the work. Researchers found high levels of nitrogen on Maui's North Shore in 2010. Starmer wanted to see if anything had changed.
The study that was done by Megan Dyler and a bunch of collaborators showed very clearly that the municipal sewage systems, our injection wells, aren't getting rid of the wastewater. They're injecting it down into the ground, and because it's freshwater, it ends up making its way through nooks and crannies back out into the ocean water where it's getting picked up. So one of the sites that we obviously wanted to double check on, since nobody really looked at it for about 10, 15 years, was the Kanaha sewage treatment plant. And, you know, not surprisingly, we found very high levels of nitrogen in that immediate area. There's also a, I guess you could call it a drainage ditch that goes back sort of towards the airport that drains that sort of industrial area that also had a high signal. That could be sewage treatment plant, could be other sources. That's sort of the next step, is to figure out where potentially some of these things are coming. That was, in a way, not surprising. We had seen this from data from prior studies, and we just said, yeah, it's still a problem. It hasn't been addressed at this point. The thing that has us a little bit puzzled was that most of the sites within Kalui Harbor had higher than normal nitrogen levels. And one site, which is at the intersection there right by the Maui Arts and Cultural Center and University of Hawaii at Maui College, had really, really high nitrogen levels, even higher than those that we saw at the sewage treatment plant, which is first time we've seen something. Usually you see high nitrogen and then the other signal, which is the nitrogen isotope signal, is really, really super high. This just had a super high nitrogen signal, and at this point it's a mystery. This is going to be something we're going to have to try and dig into a little bit more.
That's super interesting. From your perspective as the Maui Nui Resource Council, you're obviously concerned with coral reef health, and I imagine higher levels of nitrogen not necessarily good for the reefs if they tend to thrive in that low resource, low nitrogen environment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the challenge is that if you're dumping fertilizer onto a reef, what's going to grow is the plants, and limu, algae, marine algae, are just marine plants. So not all of them respond by going crazy and blooming like crazy, but unfortunately, a lot of the introduced species will do that. And we've seen Kihei in particular, South Maui, was really dealing with problems of blooms of limu, presumably due to nutrients. I'm still trying to understand what that whole story was, but you literally had enough limu that was washing up on the beaches where it was a really, really bad public health issue. It smelled bad, the stuff was rotting, and people were taking front end loaders and scraping the stuff up to get it off the beach and manage it. So that's sort of an extreme. The other thing that's interesting is, I think it has abated somewhat, but there was a big problem with tumorous growths on sea turtles, and it turned out that the relation there was nitrogen input, because it was causing certain limu to grow more abundantly and then also produce more of certain types of chemicals, which apparently triggered the tumor growth in the sea turtles. So there's some interesting sort of connections that aren't necessarily obvious when you just think about what's a typical pathway for nutrients to plants. It can actually have effects on the animals as well.
If this is indeed a problem, how do you solve it?
So actually there's a little bit of light, and the solutions to nutrient loading have been very well studied. We've got pretty good ideas. In our case, like when we're talking about the harbor, there, it's sort of a matter of trying to figure out where is this stuff coming from, and then can we address it? You know, is it a building that has a leaking treatment system? Is it a public sewer main that's maybe broken? And if you can identify it, then it's just a matter of putting the money towards fixing it. The problem with the injection wells is really the money. It's very clear what needs to happen. Injection wells aren't working the way they're supposed to. The idea was you inject it into the ground and you never see it again. And the fact that this treated water is bubbling back up into the environment is a problem. And it's not just because of the nutrients. Wastewater is a soup. I mean, if you think as an individual of all the things that you flush down the toilet, you know, there's pharmaceuticals of various sorts, there's chemicals of various sorts. All of this stuff isn't removed by the treatment process. And even though we're not looking for it, we're just using this one indicator to tell us that there's sewage or wastewater showing up on the reef. Those things all need to sort of be addressed as a whole. And I guess a little spark of hope here in Maui County is that the Maui County Council, there's a community in Malaya, a bunch of condos and apartment buildings that individually have injection wells. And they're doing on a small scale what's happening with our larger municipal injection wells. And the county of Maui has put aside money. It's, you know, not happening overnight, but they're going to build a wastewater treatment plant that will treat the water that is currently getting injected into the ground. It's going to get treated to R1 level, which is the stuff that we're using on parks and lawns and things like that. So it's recycled water, and that recycled water is going to end up generating water for fire breaks and landscaping and things like that in that area. And the idea is that will be 100% reuse, so none of the water that is being flushed down the sink, the toilet, where have you, is going to end up on the reef. It's all going to end up out on the landscape where it's actually being, you know, it becomes a useful product. And by the time that water finally does make its way back, assuming it doesn't evaporate, if it gets into the ground and all the water that gets into the ground eventually makes its way back out to the ocean, by that time, natural processes will have treated it and we would expect it not to have a wastewater signal anymore.
Well, that is definitely a hopeful sign. Talk a bit about the upcoming sampling on the west side of Maui.
Yeah, so early in the year we did South Maui again. We did North Maui about 2 months ago. And then this is sort of the last region that we've got funding for from the County of Maui EPNS program to evaluate. So this is our first time really trying to evaluate the area. Again, like I said, there's a sewage treatment plant, Kahikili area, the airport beach area, had a known problem with injection well wastewater from the sewage treatment plant coming back out on the reef. They've done a lot to clean that up, but there's still probably going to be a signal. So we're going to, you know, that's one area where we're going to sample and see what's going on. There's some other areas that the Huioka Viola, which is a volunteer-based coastal water testing program. And so these guys are actually doing the chemistry. So they're taking water samples and sending that off to UH for analysis. And they have also seen through those direct water samples elevated nitrogen in certain areas. So we're going to use the LIMU in this case. We already are expecting higher nutrient levels in those sites. And then the question is, do we pick up a wastewater signal from the LIMU to give us a little direction in terms of where can we look for what's going on there?
Is there anything else that you want to add that you want listeners to know about?
Well, we're putting this stuff out. Hopefully it becomes, you know, valuable. Like I said, a lot of the LIMU that we preferentially are testing for, because they also happen to be signals that there's groundwater flow. This is primarily the green algae. They like less salty water. So if we see those, that's telling us we've got groundwater coming out. But those are also, like I said, edible seaweeds. So if we can determine that, A, there's potentially wastewater influence, hopefully that public can say, okay, maybe that's not the LIMU that I want to collect for my poke or what have you. On the other hand, if it's, you know, there's no signal, maybe you can feel better about harvesting that stuff. The other thing is, you know, hopefully this also highlights the fact that we've had this problem for 15 years in some cases, and we haven't done anything. So it hasn't just gone away. And there are absolutely people that are moving this stuff along, and there has been progress made, but maybe we want to lean into it a little bit more if this is something that is important, because now we have data to say, yes, we still have an issue here. It hasn't really improved over time. But the other thing to highlight with all of this is it does point to the importance of groundwater. You know, we all get hyped up about brown water events, which is primarily surface runoff. The water and all of the contaminants it's carrying that we are picking up through these studies are continuous flows, right? It's always coming out. So when you're dumping stuff on the ground and it gets down into the ground due to rainwater or irrigation or what have you, that stuff is stuff where you have control over it, right? You can decide not to dump, to use fertilizer responsibly. Like I said, we're really focused on the fertilizer in this study, but everything else that you're throwing out there, whether it's waste oil, you know, using pesticides, just dumping it on the ground is not a good idea. And these studies are showing that connection, basically. What we're doing on land really has an impact on what we're seeing in the water.
Even the stuff you're not seeing, right? The stuff that you're picking up on, it's not as flashy as a brown water advisory.
Oh, no. This stuff, you can go to an area that looks absolutely wonderful and clean, and yet the lemur are picking up the fact that we've got potentially wastewater flow in some of these areas.
They know something we don't.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
That was John Starmer, Science Director of the Maui Nui Marine Resource Council. He spoke with Deshriar's Maddie Bender about using LIMU to monitor the water quality of our coastlines. Look for links to his research on our website later today. You know, so many of us drive the H3 freeway every day, but you may not remember the pushback over the construction in the valley decades ago. HPR's Cassie Gordonio has a story that brings us back to that time. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and the story has to do with images that were taken during those protests when the bulldozers were going to go in there and into that pristine valley.
Protests and even landscapes, and even we're going to see a bit of some of Kapu'lani Landgraf's poetry. And Kapu'lani Landgraf is the artist behind these images. She is a native Hawaiian photographer who has been doing this line of work since her early 20s. She actually has, many of us have seen her photos actually at the Honolulu Museum of Art, if people remember or listeners remember these portraits of prominent native Hawaiians, a lot of them who have protested controversial projects like the construction of the 30-meter telescope. And within those images, we saw We Are Not American written in their faces. So she takes more of like a stern approach to her work of art. But this line of work, actually, we're seeing these images going back to the 1980s, 1990s of the construction project of the H3, which is Kaneohe on Oahu. And so her line of work actually is on display at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York and the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And on an international scale, not just her work on the H3 project, but her documentation of landscapes on Maui, that's the one that gained international recognition from the Sharjah Biennial and the United Arab Emirates. So she's been doing this line of work for a while, and the project that, or the photography project that she was working on in her 20s, she just graduated college, and she was working alongside with the guidance of Mark Hamasaki, who's another photographer, in the 1980s.
Mark Hamasaki and I did the work on H3, documenting the construction of H3, and what happened was the Whitney Museum and LACMA purchased artwork from it to be part of their collection. And presently it's being shown at the Whitney. It's called Shifting Landscapes. It's been up since November and it's going to close in January. And that LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, it's called Nature on Notice, Contemporary Art and Ecology. And that opened in December, and it's going to close in August of this year. I think it's, I feel really fortunate. And it was because of the Hawaii Triennial that curators came down and they saw the work on H3, and they purchased the artwork. And because of that, it went into their collection as part of their collection, and it becomes part of their was being shown in their exhibitions there. I think it's an honor to be a part of their collection. And I think it's something that people need to think about more rather than for the long term, especially the work with H3, because it was such an important documentation.
Yeah, those are very powerful images.
Yeah, and the construction H3 project, it connects Pearl Harbor to what is now the Marine Corps base in Kaneohe, and the project was first discussed in a public meeting in 1965, and then the freeway opened to the public in 1997, and Kapolani Landgraf, along with Mark Kamasaki, they were documenting this work since 1989. They started this collaborative project called Piliamo'o, which means to cling. And so it's this photography project where they actually went and hiked up into that area and took photos. And in those black and white photos, it's film photography, which is very different from digital. It's like a one snapshot, and then you have to develop in a dark room, which is a little bit slower than digital photography, but the images are more eerie. So when you look at those photos that Kapolani Landgraf and Mark Kamasaki took, you see the Ko'olau mountain range in the background, and you see the very beginning of when the project first started. You see the drills kind of like up in the air from the, in the foreshadow light. And then you also see kind of this this pavement already laid down. You were seeing like basically dirt. This is before the actual cement was even put on there. And then you see the finished project towards the end. But Landgraf said this project was coming more from a student approach. She just graduated college during that time.
We were such in a rush of taking things because things were rapidly changing, like from one week to the next. So we really didn't think of the impact that it would be, right? Like over 30 years ago of what it was. So I think it was just recording something that we knew, we hoped was supposed to be the last earthwork project in Hawaii. But yeah, that didn't happen. And it's never thinking of the end. It's always thinking of what we can do to document and really record what was there before.
Yeah, because Halawa Valley has changed.
Yeah. And so Kapolani Landgraf, getting this interview with her was a bit of a challenge because many people say she's very humble. She doesn't like bragging about herself, which kind of paints the picture for her being an artist, a Native Hawaiian artist. She actually got into photography when she was actually 5 years old. She actually bought her first camera at 5 years old at some carnival for 25 cents. And since then, she teaches film photography at Windward Community College.
Yeah, but she does nice work as a photographer, absolutely a photojournalist. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Dave Schwerer's arts and culture reporter, Cassie Ordonio. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan a call-in show around fireworks enforcement. We'll hear how the 4th of July weekend went for law enforcement officers. What was it like in your neighborhood? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 and share your experience. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or most places you get your podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.